that God was outside of us. Until we came to theosophy, and we came to be told that no, God's not outside of us, God's inside. Yeah, sure, that's funny. Yeah, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. Until one begins to find out who one is, who we are. Find out, who are we? What's going on? I'm able to witness all of this, but damn, I can't control one bit of it. What am I to do? What am I to do? Well, we found that by educating ourselves, we can ease the panic. We can ease the suffering. If we had a little bit more understanding, we had a little more culture, a little more appreciation for all of life, a broader perspective of life. So, who is God? Is something controlling me? Theosophy says we are gods. Maybe not so much on this material plane, but we have the potential to become that which we truly are. But we don't believe it. No, we don't believe it, but we have to come to believe what our true potential is. Because we are told that this God that we search for is not a being. It's not a being, it's beingness. So what is beingness? Something that is, was, and always will be. Something that our mind can't conceive of. You know, it's limitless, boundless, immutable, omnipresent. That's what that is. We are that. We are that. For us to comprehend that, we must come to know that unchanging essence and culture it, nurture it, love it, want to be in its presence as much as you can. What theosophy tells, as man imagines, so it can be. This unknown essence comes forth. How? Like a great breath. And with that great breath becomes the word, becomes that first initial vibration. And we are that. We are the embodiment of all those vibrations, because those vibrations have reached out in a septenary nature. The absolute never manifests, but it shows itself like a great oversoul of intelligence and being, of divinity, because the absolute can't ever materialize. So the first essence of that is that second stage, that second plane of being. And then The third plane is mind. Then the fourth plane is our balance, our desire. For desire first arose in it. But we have this motion that is creating consciousness, creating energy, change creates change, creates motion. So this great breath comes forth, and we find ourselves in a spiraling downward. And we have come to that desire principle, which is the balance point between what we've just talked about, those higher principles. But now it must descend into lower principles. What are they? Well, desire is the balance. But below that, we have life itself, prana, jiva. But it is wedded to that astral body, that form body in which all the powers of man are manifest, and ultimately into the human form. That's that evolution downward. But as soon as the spark, the ray of that sun enters deep in within the earth, just as it's doing now. That's why this season is so strong, because that spark has reached down into the earth and is now coming forward again, rising up. That's what we're told. We need to ride that tidal wave of the seasons. So here we are at the midpoint, where we have descended into matter, and now we are self-consciously reascending to spirit. So we have become those gods. Well, the question becomes, well, how did this all take place? Well, we look at our bodies and we see all the other kingdoms. All the other kingdoms are within this body. And here we are, these mind beings, in control of it. How can that be? We control it with our mental powers. If this does not tell us that we are more than what we see, we surely aren't looking. We sure aren't pondering the realities of life. And what are those realities? Peace, calm, a clear understanding, the ability to discriminate. We see before us an opening of the mind. We see it all around. And we know in our studies that we are in the fifth root race, which correlates to what? Our fifth principle, the mind. And we are in the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race. Everything is pointing to mind. It is opening. That's why these ideas are being spread broadcast far and wide. So with that, we need knowledge. We've just talked a little bit about how sort of the universal scheme of all of this. But there's a key that we need to unlock. How does this progress in the lower kingdoms? So we'll talk about that. And after that, we'll open it up for questions. Please.
So we continue on this path of spiritual evolution at a very universal point of view for the philosophy of theosophy. Before we continue our thinking together, however, we need to be very aware that our thinking can be influenced or impressed by a popularized set of belief systems from the greater society. We're all influenced by that. We need to be very aware of the filters or lenses or preconceptions with which we might come to the whole notion of the path of spiritual evolution as it pertains to evolution of the lower kingdoms. Plato said ideas rule the world. For the scientists among us, the Darwinian concepts of a theory may have been accepted. Survival of the fittest, form, development over all else, and the accompanying misapplications in the dog-eat-dog world of economics, fine power, class, social caste. For the religionists among us, there's the notion of the creation theory. Man is as the recipient of original sin, of nature as a servant to be plundered, or perhaps guided by stewards of the human kingdom. But from that line of thinking, we have to be aware of a separatism of the kingdoms, us and them. And then, of course, there's the sentimentalists, thinkers among us who animate or anthropomorphize pets, plants, crystals, a very sentimental, loving, but very limited point of view. Again, often us and them, a parenting point of view. But if we open our minds and hearts to theosophical premise that there is a path of spiritual evolution that is universally available to one and to all, then we need to consider that from mineral dust to the brain of the most enlightened philosopher, spiritual evolution is universally available. And that spiritualized humans rule the world not through changing ideas and lenses and filters, but rather they rule the world through the creative process of ideation. We've just heard some statements about the lower kingdom existing certainly in an array in our physical form. And we're very aware in the stages of fetal development that there is an array of forms that progresses, that appears to recapitulate, to echo the evolution of forms at the very earliest of rounds and races. In our common world that we share, we know that there are natural forces, elements. We see minerals. We sense the vegetation around us, animals around us. We puzzle over the plight of great primates. We're very aware of animal man versus that internal, eternal conscience of higher mind and higher man. And therefore, we come to the philosophical premise that there may be root types of various forms, but that does not imply an evolution from one form to another. It does not imply transmigration any more than using a body, living in and through a physical body of all the lower kingdoms, implies that the human nature is the body alone, that there isn't something else that's higher. So what could a newcomer to the philosophy do? Well, there's a number of different avenues of reading about this and researching this. One is in the Ocean of Theosophy, articles by William Q. Judge in chapter 3, where a slow, orderly rounds of development of evolution is described, where we learn that the mineral forms developed as matter hardened or began to set in the later third round. And that in the mineral form, we can see degrees of intelligence, degrees of being or beingness, response to the laws of cohesion, cause and effect, attraction and repulsion, the potential for conductivity of electricity that varies from mineral form to mineral form, from element to element. We also learn about the vegetable forms, and certainly modern science, with experiments even conducted in the primary grades, demonstrates that in vegetable forms, we see life sensual, that there's a developing sensitivity or response to light, to water, to soil, to even an impressionable sense or reaction to human thought, voice, contact. We see memory in seeds that may have been found in caves that are thousands of years old, under the right circumstances, responding to an environment, coming alive and developing vegetable forms. We see scientific investigation of the cooperation that goes on among and between trees in a pine forest. In the ocean, we also read about the ocean of animal forms, the great diversity of animal forms. And therein, a student of the philosophy of theosophy can look into a more developed, perhaps, expression, better conditions to express life, mind. We see in the animal form instinct operating, mobility, a limited use of will according to instinct, and an incredible, impressionable state where human contact can have tremendous influence. And then for the self-aware student who's looking at the difference between animal man and spirit in the human state of animal man, we're reminded in The Secret Doctrine in Volume 2 that the human state as we know it, the lit up self-conscious man of 18 million years ago, occurred in what the scientists call the Jurassic Age, what the philosophy terms the Lemurian period. We see the beginning of self-consciousness, life and spirit exhibited in the conditioned ability for free will and choice based on logic, self-identifying use of force according to desires and priorities, intuition as a promise, as a potential. And always the body has the direct consciousness of the animal kingdom. but we're reminded that once a man, always a man. The only unique cases we can see in the lower kingdoms might be that of the wheat plant or the bee or the great primates. If you want to look into how this evolution of the lower kingdoms has occurred from universals to particulars, you can refer to a text called 5 Years of Theosophy. It has within it a reprint of an excerpt from Esoteric Buddhism by Sinnett. And there's a wonderful chart on page 277 in which the animal, the mineral monad, excuse me, is seen as a pivotal point of earlier ethereal degrees of evolution and the latter day development of physicality of the lower kingdoms. So in the mineral light, we see, in the mineral form, we see latent life, one monadic essence, the beginning of a spiraling progression, culminating in the reunification of soul with the spirit, full spirit, in the devas. Sequential, progressive, automatic impulse of life in the lower kingdoms. And as was previously stated by my fellow panelists, that in the human kingdom, there's something else that blooms, that's operating. In the Key to Theosophy, we can read about the notion of the lower kingdoms only appearing unconscious to our finite consciousness in the human state. And we know, we puzzle, don't we, as a society, trying to explain the autistic, the catatonic, the comatose in the human state. So we know that this so-called unconsciousness of the lower kingdoms is also yet another puzzle. But ideas rule the world. Life, soul, being, the ego, in a given state of consciousness or form, seems to other beings in the same state to be identical with form. And in the philosophy of theosophy, we've got the premise of the pivotal doctrine that man, spirit moving through the human kingdom, man is a self-conscious, ideating force, an entity of nature. Man is the karmic agent of the current evolution in all of the lower kingdom. Man is the thinker, the meaning maker, and therefore we can raise up all of that if only we would. So to recap a little bit in the contrast between popularized theory and the eternal ancient truths of the propositions of the philosophy, we're reminded that Darwin said that the geological record is imperfect. It's written in a changing dialect. And of this history, only the last volume is known. And of that volume, it is only known in 2 to 3 countries. So even the thinker who promoted this theory of physical evolution knew well that there was something greater, something far more permanent, something that would emerge across time as perception and ideation grew. And that there was far more to just physical science research. And ultimately, as a student of philosophy, you're invited to look at The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2. On page 738, way in the back of the Volume 2, there's a table that also contrasts popularized materialistic thinking and the philosophical thinking. That there are basic astral prototypes that pass into physical expression, that there is dhyanic shahanic impulse, the impulse of spirit inherent and necessary in all development, and that it lies behind all minor agencies. So there's an unknowable cause, spirit, that lies behind the evolution that we see or sense in all the minor agencies. And in the SD, Blavatsky states that matter on this terrestrial plane manifests with natural forces. It is right that terrestrial plane, lower kingdom, is varied in a sevenfold way. You can see this in this chart on page 738 of volume 2, that there's variation transmitted by heredity, there's natural selection, there's sexual selection, there's physiological selection. Isolation geographically plays a role, that there's a correlation of growth possible, and that we also see adaptation to any particular environment that is intelligent in all the lower kingdoms rather than just merely mechanical. But these are secondary terrestrial forces alone, producing variation of form alone, incapable of touching, changing, or influencing spirit. So in the inner soul of the physical cell is a spiritual plasma. And that plasm dominates all of the germinal plasm. As we're reminded by the Kuan Yin pledge to be of service, to see the spiritual evolution as dual. There's an involution of spirit, power, potential. There's the evolution of conditions allowing perception and application to grow. And that this yield is from mineral dust all the way to the deva state. That what we now perceive as life or latent life in the lower kingdoms will at some point in this tremendous manifestation from the abstract and the absolute, at some point, all of these points of life, all these points of sensitivity will have their time in the sun to bloom. But yet in the Kuan Yin pledge, we're invited to become again as a stone, as a stone in the guardian wall of all spiritual evolution, protective, strong, energized, enduring, eternal, but for a purpose, for the protection and guidance of all. So those are our panel presentations for this morning. You probably came to the session with ideas of your own on the subject. SL, your hand is up.
With these both presentations, first from the universal perspective and then from the perspective of evolution in the lower kingdoms, could we have a few ideas as to how we can make this practical in our lives?
Could you repeat the last phrase, how we can?
How we can make this information, these ideas we just heard, practical in our lives.
How to make it practical. Well, as we move through life using a physical body, we know we have a couple of tasks at hand each day: to attain self-consciousness, to make real oneness with the universal self, to raise matter up to higher and higher states. And if we're using physical bodies that include all these lower kingdoms, physical bodies in environments where there's animal, vegetable, mineral, all about us, as we maintain a calm mind, a pure heart, a sense of loving oneness with all of those lives, as that energy is exchanged and we take it in we impress it or influence it according to those guidelines and then emit it and let it go, telegraph it into the world. In a most practical sense, we are the karmic agents of all of the evolution of all those forms of matter that we touch in our sphere of influence. MW, do you have any addition to that?
Well, yes, we come to study the Bhagavad Gita, and we find that this has been a problem from the ages, that there is more history than I ever thought existed. But it's said that we've been of this one being for 18 millions of years, where we have become self-conscious. 18 million years. We can't imagine how many civilizations we have lived in. We can't imagine how many people we know. I think these ideas broaden our understanding. They sort of stretch the mind beyond what is usually stretched. You know, we have an outside God that's protecting us. You know, we don't think about anything. But we're told that if we don't think, we're not theosophists. If you don't think, you never would have found us in the first place. If you don't think, you're not excited. So, yeah, I mean, these ideas seem very abstract, but if we read the secret doctrine, that's what we have to develop in ourselves, that abstract intelligence where we can apply one thing to another and we see the relationship.
And practically speaking, it would seem where we're sitting in 2021, the entire planet is screaming for assistance. Just the amount of earthquakes that occurred on January 15th was outlandish. We, practically speaking, as we attempt to lead our lives in a kindly, compassionate, loving manner, we generate force. And we can bring tremendous calm and tremendous uplift to everything around us if only we could maintain that meditative stance, I guess, 24/7. Easier said than done sometimes. SL?
If there's no other question, we were wondering if we could extend this discussion as to why we must use these ideas. Why is it so imperative that we use it not just individually in our own lives, but why must we apply this at this time in terms of the evolution of the lower kingdoms? Is it an option?
Well, there's always an option. There's always an option. But there's a plan. And that's one of harmony. That's one of cooperation. We look in the world today, it's in turmoil or in strife. So we are told. Is that the world that we want? Is that what we want to see? There has to be different ideas being placed before the public. And what's happening right now is the result of the ideas that were being held. It's nothing more than that. We have to change our ideas. And to do that, we have to discover who we are and must take responsibility for it. We all must take responsibility.
Also, I've read in the philosophy that there's a pivotal doctrine to evolution. In other words, in the lower kingdoms, everything moves by natural impulse, culminating even in intuition. So from the monad of the mineral, where there's this oneness of existence and latency, through all the way to the animal forms, where there's a degree of mobility and will based on instinct, there's still that force of a natural impulse. But once the human state is achieved, once that condition is taken on by a communion, if you will, of mind, spirit, of matter, once that happens, then all progress, all growth, all evolution proceeds by self-fulfilled and self-devised means. So while there seems to be choice, an array of choices, really those who don't consider responsibility as including a spiritual brotherhood with all in manifestation are actually charging karma, aren't they? They're putting off, procrastinating for another day, great lessons to be learned. And for those of us that have begun to be open to these ideas and to consider them and the impact, the moral impact of how these might apply in an everlasting, ongoing process, the choice really has begun to be made. All these little moments of choice are already very, very active. Carl Jung wrote, where love rules, there is not will to power. And where power predominates, there love is lacking. The one is the shadow of the other. So we have a definite choice. If we are these entities of these dynamos of spirit and mind and matter, heart personified, if we are that, are we to move according to the laws of compassion and love and universal brotherhood, or are we to reject that stance?
LT has had his hands up a few times.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So let me speak a little bit loud on this one. It's interesting, JS mentioned about the January 15th uneasiness with these earthquakes, and it really came to mind that a lot of what we are experiencing as humans and as animals, that the earth is also experiencing. So there is a imbalance between every kingdom on this planet. And it comes to mind that there are humans that don't have the concept of this harmony. So I think it's in a matter of learning how to conduct this energy to benefit every kingdom on this planet. And so some have no concept of that, and some, like us, are very in tune with that and are learning through theosophy how to channel this energy and bring peace to this balance. And I think it's instrumental through theosophy. Thank you.
We have been very fortunate studying together, coming together in Zoom sessions as we do from a variety of different locations. We have the potential of sharing ideas and sparking ideas in each other. But we're reminded also that throughout the globe, among folks who have never ever heard the word theosophy, there are many operating on the basis of conscience not with formal education, perhaps, perhaps practicing dogmatic traditional creeds, perhaps in living in a very primitive, close to nature lifestyle. But there are many, many, many around the globe dedicating themselves in a pure sense to uplifting, to helping others, to try to embody what they see as universally good. And as long as they're in the service of free will and the development of free thought, can't we call them all theosophists? MJW and MHW, there's a hand up.
Yes, hi. The question that we have is in regards to companion animals. And we read off and on where we're actually holding their evolution back. So what do we, how do we, I guess, resolve that? It's like, you know, people that have cats and dogs, it's like we love them. And the thought of holding back such a huge issue as their evolution is kind of daunting. I mean, what do we do? How do we resolve that kind of a question? There's that idea of nature unaided fails. So we can kind of combine those two ideas. And how do we resolve this issue with our pets?
In the 18th chapter of the Gita, we're reminded to act as seemest best to thou. And I'm not just punting on the response, but to remain mindful, very, very, very mindful as we coexist with our companion animals, whether it's wildlife in the backyard that we're trying to feed during the winter, whether it's some animal or even plant form, frankly, for some folks that are resident in our homes that we have a caretaker or a stewardship available to, we can be as mindful as possible. Are we taking great care not to be too sentimental, not to anthropomorphize the plant or the animal? Not to dress one of these poor little souls up as human infants to try to become a surrogate parent. To question, if I'm using a baby carriage to transport an animal on a walk, am I really helping that animal develop its physical stamina and good health? There's so many different ways to come to this consideration. What's the best for the animal? If I have had animals arrive at my doorstep looking for a home, and I bring them in and the motive is to protect them from the elements and to allow them as much freedom as possible to follow their own hearts and instincts, is that okay? Was the motive to go to some sort of la-di-da pet shop or breeder to purchase at extremely high cost some breed animal? Well, what's the motive behind that? Is it power, prestige? What's going on? The very process of being self-aware, introspective, and then doing the best we can with the animals we've rescued or that have chosen us or the plants that are suddenly on our windowsills, to remain impersonal, but loving and compassionate, to provide a home, a household, as peaceful as possible, as respectful that in this other form, there's a brother or a sister, not in a sentimental way, but truly in a potential spiritual way, an impact of oneness. MW, can you save us with more?
Yeah, well, yes, I've been, SL keeps on muting me. And I keep on having statements that I'm talking to myself, but here I go. Here we go. That, you know, the question comes down to one thing. And it's a quote from a spiritual teacher. And he simply says, be kind. Be kind. So, and the text below is, you know, a country or a civilization is known by how they treat their animals. And, you know, this, the idea that we are a universal brotherhood is so fundamental. We control these bodies. We control all the lower kingdoms. And if we don't see that, we're blind. We're blind. And it says that the three lower kingdoms before the mineral kingdom are those elemental kingdoms. And that the monad is the balance point, or the mineral is the balance point. And from the mineral, we precede up to the human kingdom. TK? TK?
We're here.
All right.
Well, you know, certainly we've read the statement in the philosophy where it talks about how we, if we keep pets, we hold back their evolution. Yet to greater nature when we live our lives according to the higher life, we're contributing to evolution of all the kingdoms. Our concern as regards individual pets is that it suggests that if I have a dog, then I'm holding back its evolution, but when that dog's dead, it's not an individualized soul. It kind of goes back into the ocean of soulness, unlike human beings. The human being as an individualized soul is coming back. We can't say that about a dog, can we? So, just an observation, kind of interesting. It's not a conflict of ideas. Is it that we're holding back the entire species of dog in that one little dog? Is that the implication?
But evolution is not static. It's ever changing. It's ever moving. So that, yeah, it may be a dog, but he may at some point transition into another kingdom. Because it is not the form. It's the expression of the spirit that is evolving. Yes, TK.
But that implies that the spiritual essence of the dog is the dog and is coming back as a dog. A dog. Eventually, it'll be more than a dog, and that's what's. That's the opposite of what we're trying to say. The human being is individualized and does come back, but the dog doesn't come back per se. That's like having a glass of water that we scooped out of the ocean and throwing it back into the ocean. You can't get that same glass of water back.
So. Yeah, but how that water was treated, that goes back into the ocean. And it's the same ocean for the dog. Okay.
Yeah, so there's life and force, and as we move through evolution, we bring experience into the mix. And certainly a companion animal resident in a home is going to have a very different experience than the animal in the wilds. And those people that are involved in the rescue of wildlife know the tremendous effort it takes to try to rehabilitate injured animals maintain their skills so that they can once again return to great nature. We have a whole bunch of chats that are popping up.
Quick, we only have a few minutes or minute.
We only have a few minutes. So there's one chat that says Mohandas Gandhi stated, and I'm paraphrasing, a society is judged by how they treat their animals.
Yes.
Another statement is, at a certain point in discipleship, the keeping of animals and even contact with other kingdoms takes away from one's development. And again, motive comes into play with that chat. Are we keeping away from lower kingdoms in order to be uniquely saved, or are we in an effort to become more and more universal? What's the motive becomes really imperative.
Or what is the attraction? Why do humans want the companionship of the animals?
Yeah.
Why do we want it? That's why we get it. That's what we do. But we have to take responsibility. Why do we want that companionship?
Now, on that note, we're reaching 12 o'clock noon, and there's one more share, which is this. In the end, will not the true essence of mankind and all animals through moksha unite in oneness with the supreme essence? And the answer is, of course, yes. Yeah. That's for each of us to say, that we need to do our own research and consideration of that very, very wonderful point. So it's 12 o'clock. Our time is up. And we invite you back to Zoom in on Wednesday night, if you will, please. 7:30 promptly. Take care and be safe.
Bye, everybody.